You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
Let's do it later.
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy?
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th, hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
Welcome to First Things First. I'm Jenna Wolf. That's the Hall of Famer, Chris Carter. This is Nick Wright. Good morning, gentlemen. Got a fun couple of hours for you today. Big show, Cowboys coming to a crossroads with Dak Prescott, finally. Kevin Durant's got some words for Patrick Beverley, but we will start this morning with last night's NBA action. Start with Pacers-Celtics. Game two. Here we go. Kyrie Irving went off in this one. Game high, 37 points, including that fadeaway right there in the fourth. But under a minute left, Pacers leading by two. Al Horford blocking Bojan Bogdanovic. Then on the other end, Jaylen Brown finds Jason Tatum in the corner for three. Celtics up one. 15 seconds left. Same score. Tatum to Gordon Hayward. Celtics win 99-91. They now have a 2-0 series lead in this one. Here is Kyrie Irving after the game.
It felt good. It felt good to be here in this position, playing in this arena. It's just been a long journey. From having those two knee surgeries and watching the team last year and finally getting a chance to lace them up for the Boston Celtics in the NBA playoffs, it's nothing like it.
Well, this is certainly a more relaxed, a kinder demeanor from Kyrie Irving than we have seen in the last couple weeks at the end of the regular season when this team was struggling and trying to find their way back on track. How impressive, CEC, was Kyrie last night?
Very impressive. I think that for the first time that Kyrie's been in Boston, that this looked like his team. And he was playing the type of basketball, and for a number of different reasons. I think he's in the best shape that he's been in since he was in Boston. You could see that last night, almost playing 40 minutes. And the intensity for which he played at, I didn't think he was going to be able to maintain that after having a great first half. He was able to maintain that into the third quarter and finish him off with a great fourth quarter. So his ability now to be able to dominate the whole game compared to Celtics going to stay around, and then Kyrie is one of the best finishers that we have, closers that we have in basketball. Because last year, before he got hurt, that's what they talked about. This year, when they played some of their best basketball with him on the court, that's what they've talked about. But Kyrie Irving's a superstar. He can dominate the whole game. And for me, the first time, it was like this franchise was his. And I hadn't even heard until just now the sound bites coming after the game. And he mentioned, talked about playing in this building, playing for this team, you know, because them and the Lakers have the most storied history in the NBA. And to me, he finally, even though he didn't request going to Boston, he finally started to understand what Kyrie Irving in the Celtics green, what it could mean playoff time. So very impressed with how he played.
Kyrie was absolutely sensational. This was one of the best playoff games of his career, because this was the first great playoff game of his career where he had to be the guy, where he didn't have the guy playing alongside him, and they would have lost without him. Him playing as well as he had 37 points, and they're trailing with a minute left. They could have lost despite how well he played. He was brilliant in every quarter. It wasn't just the closing finish. Mm-hmm. He had 9+ points in every quarter of the game. He was consistent. And credit to Brad Stevens, because they were down 12 at the very start of the fourth quarter. The Pacers hit a three. They then went ice cold. They hit a three to go up 12. Stevens stuck with his rotation. The Celtics go on an 8-0 run before Kyrie checks in to cut it to four. And then Kyrie himself goes on an 8-0 run to turn a 12-point deficit into a 4-point lead. He was great, and the Celtics executed down the stretch in the final 2 minutes when the Pacers fell totally apart in the final couple minutes of this game. That's how the Celtics won this game and prevented the Pacers, who could have won, from stealing home court advantage.
Look, 2 weeks ago, the narrative surrounding this Celtics team was, sure, Kyrie's putting up great numbers, but this team doesn't seem to win when he's on the court. Can they flip a switch and make a run in the playoffs? Now you've seen two great games from Kyrie, who somehow has gotten the whole team involved. They seem to be on the same page. CeCe, are you buying that Kyrie and the rest of the team can now make a run?
It's going to be hard for them to make a run because, I mean, the Pacers were in control of this game. The Pacers could have won this game. Now, I like the way Kyrie was playing. I like that basically him and Tatum, they're going to take most of the shots for the Celtics. If they stay, that's the way they should be. They're two best offensive players, and you'll have Horford. He'll have a good game. You'll have Jalen. He'll chip in with a good game here. But I like the way they established with him and Tatum. Kyrie took over, was big late, and then Tatum closed them out with a couple of special plays at the end. I thought you made a great point about Brad Stevens and his overall adjustment, because this year he's been criticized more than any other season because this is the most talented roster, and sometimes people question his rotation or is his coaching style good
conducive
with talent?
For this much talent. Yeah, and so, listen, this was, to answer your question, Jenna, I still think the absolute ceiling for the Celtics is losing in the second round of the Bucks. I think that they, I don't think this is going to be a 4 or 5 game series against Indiana. I think Indiana looks at this series, they're down 0-2, and they say, in the first game, we held Boston to 84. It was just that we only scored 74. Indiana in game one, in the third quarter, made 2 baskets. In game two, in the fourth quarter, made 4 baskets. They fell apart offensively at the end, and credit to the Celtics defense. But the bigger picture to me, the bigger story is what Kyrie was able to do and what the Celtics were able to do when it looked like the Pacers were in control. Because they were. The Pacers were in control the entirety of the third quarter and then the start of the fourth quarter.
But is that not what we've seen in the regular season?
What do you mean?
Have they not been able to finish out games that suddenly they are able to hold on and finish out games?
Well, I mean, they almost won 50 games. So they weren't, it's not as if the Celtics were a disaster this year. They couldn't string together a 3-week stretch the way they wanted to.
A lot of the Celtics' disappointment had to do with expectations.
Yes.
We expect them to win more games than that. We expect them to be competing for a championship, representing the Eastern Conference. With the success that they had last year, Gordon Hayward, if he's healthy, Kyrie Irving, if he's healthy, Brad Stevens, one of the best minds that we have in the NBA, they're supposed to be competing for championships. So I think the expectations, and then they only get to 50 games, that right there becomes the issue.
And to your point, you did it during the highlight. Yes, the Celtics go on a 16-0 run to turn a 12-point deficit into a 4-point lead. But with a minute left in the game, the Pacers are up 2 with the ball. And then two guys who have to be good for them other than Kyrie make great plays. Al Horford has a block. If he doesn't make that block, the Pacers are up 4 with 50 seconds left, and they're going to win that game. And then in transition, you find Tatum open in the corner. Tatum in this series now, he's 6 of 9 from 3. He's 17 of 31 overall. He's averaging 21 points per game. He has been that second star. Horford a little under the weather. Marcus Smart injured. So the Celtics, they needed a lot to happen just to win this game. So that's why I'm not ready to say it's solved in Boston. They flipped a playoff switch. But Kyrie, this was an important game for his career. This was an important game for him to know, I can play like I played in the playoffs alongside LeBron without LeBron being there. 37 points, incredibly efficient, distributing the basketball, and helped them come back in the fourth quarter from a double-digit deficit. A great game from Kyrie Irving.
And distributing is the key, finally getting everybody involved, which is what Brad Stevens has been trying to do all season. We'll take a break. Coming up on the other side, let's talk some football. Should the Cowboys pay Dak like the Seahawks paid Russell Wilson? That's next on FS1. You can always check us out on the Fox Sports channel on Sirius XM. We'll be right back. Back here, first things first. We'll get to the Cowboys in just a second. But first, Celtics, Pacers, game 2. Kyrie stops on a dime, nails the fadeaway.
That is the exact spot, not quite the exact move, but that he opened game 1 with. Remember the game 1, he did the little half spin move. This was not to open the game.
Yeah, he had all kind of bounce in his legs. Nick, you and I talked at the beginning of the season. It's how he came into the season not in the best shape.
Mm-hmm. He looked like it last night.
Bucks and Pistons, Giannis backing down Thon Maker, then dunks on him.
This is what I love about this, because every time you have guys on your team, they swear up and down. If I was on another team, I'd be difficult, man. I'd be getting in your stuff. Okay. Remember we used to be on the same team?
Thon used to be a Buck. They drafted him. I liked him when they drafted him. Didn't work out. There's one of those unassisted dunks, though, from Giannis.
Same game. Oh, no. Thon looking for revenge. Giannis, though, sends that shot out of bounds.
What did he send out of bounds, Jenna?
The shot.
Oh, okay. Good job.
Yeah. Now, which one do you like better? The way he patted the ball? Pap. That's watching patting with his left hand on his backside afterwards.
Oh, yeah. He's like, good job, young fella.
Nice try, young fella.
Man, Giannis is just annihilating the Pistons.
Finally, Rockets and Jazz.
Oh, no.
James Harden with time puts Ricky Rubio on skates with the vicious crossover.
You just got to run in the locker room after that, Ricky. You got to pretend you tweaked a hamstring and just keep going to the tunnel.
No, man, he missed a shot. Let's go. We got possession. Let's go down the other side. Man, you can recover from this, man.
I don't care that he missed the shot.
Yeah, I know.
It would have been better if he made it.
This is the thing. I would love to be in the NBA and have someone make me look foolish. Compared to watching games on TV.
Oh, yeah,
so I would love to get mixed up. Man, cross me over.
Get mixed
up. Man, do me. Yes, man, slam on me. I'll be in the lane like this. Take it all in.
All right, to the Cowboys now. All right, here's the deal with the Cowboys. Dak Prescott wants to get paid, right? And on the heels of Russell Wilson's record-breaking contract, Dak figures to be the next quarterback to sign a long-term extension. Well, Cowboys CEO Stephen Jones has said that Dak might have to take a team-friendly deal. Jones met the media yesterday.
I don't feel any pressure to rush the situation. I mean, this is an important contract for Dak. It's an important contract for our organization. We have to get it right, and I feel like we'll do that.
CeCe, can the Cowboys even afford to make Dak Prescott the highest paid quarterback in the league?
One of the highest paid, or the highest paid?
Yeah, definitely not going to be the highest paid. I don't think that's part of the conversation. They have to make him one of the highest paid because that's just the price of doing business. Dak Prescott has started for them for three straight seasons. He's been consistent where he's been in the lineup. And typically when we have that, when quarterbacks, if you are a starter and you can stay healthy, and given Dak that his upside is into the future, they have to be able to pay him. Like Dak, he's no fluke. But he is a product of what Dallas has put there. They got a great offensive line, tremendous running game, and now they have Amari Cooper. They have to build a building. Why did you trade a first-round pick for Amari Cooper? Do you want someone else throwing to him? Because that's what the Dallas Cowboys have to do now. With Amari Cooper, he's going to get signed after Dak. Ezekiel Elliott will get signed after Dak and after Amari, but they have to sign him. Now, Nick has a different theory as far as the salary cap and if you pay a guy a certain amount and franchise him, because that could be an option. Dallas has decided that's not the way they're going to do it. They've talked about it. They've been consistent about it. So for me, it's not a matter of what I want. I know the Cowboys are going to sign him. And if they can get him between $25 to $28 million, it's going to be a good deal for the Cowboys. Right now, we got 16 quarterbacks. We got 13 making $20 million. We got three making $30 million. So if you're going to have someone like Dak Prescott, regardless if you think, oh, is Dak a passer? Is he a game manager? It doesn't matter. Phillip Rivers making $20 million. Eli's making $20 million. Ben making $21 million. Nick Foles, $22 million. Joe Flacco, $22 million. Alex Smith, what does he want? $23 million. Jimmy Garoppolo, $27.5 million. What does he want? So Dak has some names and stuff out there that he can attach himself to, and given that it's the latest deal, and get a bump on those deals and make them right in the middle of the pack of the top quarterbacks. But they have no choice, Jenna.
And so Stephen Jones seems to, at least to my eye, be walking back a little bit, trying to change the parameters of the conversation. Of course, we're getting Dak signed, but no, there's no pressure on us. And no, for the quarterback, it's important to understand that it's not just about financial compensation. It's about winning compensation, having guys around you. Because Stephen understands this. The difference between $22 million a year and $28 million a year is one other really good player. That is the way, to me, the Cowboys are looking at this. He's not going to get $30 million. I don't think anyone believes he's going to get $30 million. He's not going to beat Russell. He's not going to beat Aaron Rodgers. But if he gets above Jimmy Garoppolo at $28 million, or if he gets 5 years, $110 million at $22 million, that's $6 million a year spread. That is, for any other position, a pretty darn good player. Not an all-pro level player, but a very good player. And so that's what the Cowboys are trying to figure out here. And that's what where the push and the pull and the negotiation is going to take place. Chris Wright, I had said all along, I would not have started the conversation on Dak Prescott extension. But that horse is not only out of the barn, that horse is out of the state. Like, they know they are extending him. So now we're arguing about details. We're arguing about where is he going to be on the list of highest paid quarterbacks. And if you're going to build a team the right way, it needs to be around the same spot he's on the list of just how good are the quarterbacks. The guys Chris mentioned, what are the teams in trouble? The Giants, because Eli is not playing to that level. The Washington, because Alex Smith is injured, so he can't produce that level. What's a team that's in a really good spot? The Chargers, because Phillip Rivers is worth more than the level that he's playing. The Vikings will find out this year. So the Cowboys are trying to put themselves in a position where his compensation is in line with his level of play, and that's the rub here.
And that's also the problem. I don't think anyone can accurately predict his level of play because there's been such a discrepancy between year one, year two, and year three. There are also other variables like whether Zeke was in the lineup or not. So what are you paying him on? You're paying him on his potential, the same way they paid Matthew Stafford, more or less on his potential, the way they paid Jimmy Garoppolo, obviously on his potential, Derek Carr. So is he in line with those quarterbacks? Are you taking a gamble that you're going to pay him as if he's going to now take this franchise to the next level like he did in game one?
Right.
Year one, rather?
The only quarterback I would remove from that list is Matthew Stafford.
Is he thrown for 5,000 yards?
And yes.
He had established
despite himself. The team not winning,
right.
You would just,
yes.
Okay.
And because he was a high draft pick for that team. So continuing to have him signed and he has played well enough for me.
Okay.
Does throw too many interceptions, but as far as accomplished in numbers, he's in a different class.
Because replace Stafford with Derek Carr. They paid Derek
Carr
on potential.
Yes, Garoppolo.
Yes, absolutely. Because
yeah.
Derek Carr, Jimmy Garoppolo, Kirk Cousins, and Alex Smith. If you look at them collectively, they're averaging about 25, 26 million.
Right.
And if Dak Prescott, if signing me for 20 million and 26 million, that's not Dak's problem. What Nick's talking about, that's not Dak's problem. Dak is, I come here and do my job. I'm going to pick up my check. What y'all decide to do with the rest of that salary cap, that's your job, Steven. That's your dad's job. All right? That's not my job. But he has earned that. Didn't they win a playoff game? Yes. Okay? Mm-hmm. Garoppolo, what has he won in the playoffs?
Nothing.
No. What about Derek Carr? What has he won in the playoffs?
Right.
Alex Smith, what's he going to do? Okay?
Right.
So he has a group of quarterbacks that he can attach himself to and say, listen, I deserve that because the market is already paying. And I'm not even going to get into some Mike Glennon, what he was making. Sam Bradford made $20 million last year. Like, so Dak has a real legitimate case, and I believe that he deserves it, and I believe the Cowboys are going to have to pay him.
And this is, I understand this is spilt milk. This is the past, and you can't look to the past. You got to look ahead. But this is why that not finding a way to take advantage of the one seed Dak's rookie year hurts. And then Zeke kind of submarining year two with the suspension hurts even more. And then last year, the slow start and not getting your offense going until you got Amari Cooper and putting a ceiling on what you could realistically do hurts even more. Because once, to Chris's point, once the quarterback is not on a rookie scale, if he is league average starter, it's $20-plus million. So that is the going rate for quarterbacks now. I was hesitant a year ago. I would have been hesitant a year ago thinking about, you pay Dak Prescott $20 million. But when you do look at the names and you say, okay, what tier is Alex Smith in when he was healthy? What tier was Kirk Cousins in when he signed his deal? And those guys are in the mid to high 20s. So it's just flatly, once you are no longer on your rookie salary scale, the minimum for a quarterback is $20 million bucks if you're a starter.
Yeah.
That's the league
get
minimum,
used
essentially.
To it. The right. Public need to get used to it. Nick Wright need to get used to it.
And so it's just you can take advantage of that window or you can't. Once you don't, then things get a lot harder. For the Cowboys, what works in their advantage is they don't have the dead money they used to have on the roster.
Right.
They don't have some of these albatross contracts, assuming the offensive line gets back to the level it should be. But they're going to have their highest paid players play like that in order to succeed.
The biggest
in this
problem
method.
With that theory is, Nick, we're not going to see a lot of young quarterbacks in their first 4 years
win a Super Bowl.
Play high, to a high enough level that they can carry their team to the Super Bowl.
Right.
So we can have a theory. Yes, it would be nice if you could get him when he's going to make the least amount of money. Yes, it does help the books. But that guy's not going to be playing his best football. So we just have to get used to it.
But Dak played his best football.
He's going to play better. He's going to play better than that. Yes.
All right, let's take a break. Coming up, did you hear what Kevin Durant said? Kevin Durant and Steve Kerr disagree on the strategy for game 3 against the Clippers. Hear from KD next on First Things First. Stories start your morning.
Tell Jenna.
That is true.
Chris has lost too.
That is true. The Celtics beat the Pacers last night in game 2. 99-91 was your final. 37 points from Kyrie Irving. So Boston now up 2-0 in that series. CC, is Kyrie proving he can carry the Celtics on a long playoff run?
I like where they are. I like the way that they've changed some things from Brad Stevens. They're basically running the offense through Kyrie and Tatum, especially late in the game. So, yes, Kyrie, to me, not in this series. I always knew if he was healthy and if he's focused, this is the kind of player that Kyrie is, Nick.
I don't think the Celtics are going to go on a long playoff run, but I think Kyrie Irving is proving to himself and the league, if people had skepticism, he can be the best player on a high-level playoff team. Now, I don't think next year he's going to have to be the best player on a high-level playoff team because I think he's going to team up with somebody. But this was an important game for him. He had only his second career playoff game ever without LeBron. His first game, he wasn't that great. Mm-hmm. He was spectacular last night.
I think the difference between Kyrie and some of the other guys trying to prove themselves, Kyrie's saying, I'm back because he's already done it.
Absolutely. Right.
Moving on, the Bucks demolished the Pistons last night in game 2. They won 120-99. How about Giannis? 26 points, 12 rebounds in 30 minutes of play. Bledsoe had 27. Middleton had 24. Nick, can anyone compete with this team in the East?
Oh, I think the Raptors will give them a good series. Now, I think the Bucks are going to win. I think the Bucks are the favorites versus the field in the East. Mm-hmm. But the Raptors give them a good series. But this thing ends Sunday. This thing isn't even a gentleman's sweep. This is a regular old-fashioned sweep. Any hope the Pistons had evaporated when Blake was ruled out for the series.
Yeah, but this is what we've seen from the beginning of the season to the end of the season. They've been the best team in the NBA, Jenna. We shouldn't be surprised that they continue that against a Pistons team without their best player. But, man, I'm looking forward to round number 2 because I haven't seen a star as calm as Giannis is as far as letting the game come to him. He doesn't have to be a volume shooter and can affect the game in so many different ways, rebounding, defensive,
everywhere.
Rockets also cruised in game 2 last night. They beat the Jazz 118-98. James Harden had 32 points, 13 boards, 10 assists. The Beer, just the 6th player with multiple 30-point triple-doubles in the playoffs. What do you think, Chris? The series, is this a lock?
Oh, it's definitely a lock that Houston's going to get through. But I was listening to the coach last night talk after the win. He said, yeah, I'm excited about this team. James Harden is better than he was last year. Chris Paul is healthy, and we feel like our other parts that we've added have given us a – he said, I'm excited about where we're going. So
I think he
they believes, are trending at the right time, Nick.
I think he believes what I believe, that this team's better than the team last year. Even though they didn't win 65 games, they don't have home court, they are deeper. Chris Paul is at the same level. Capella's better, and Harden is better than his MVP season. This is – my worry for the Jazz this series is how can they score? They're yet to crack 100 points in this series. I don't know if they do that back in Utah. If you don't get into the 105-110 range, you're not beating the Rockets in a single
game. Our biggest thing, we were fooled by Houston because they had so many injuries that they didn't have that win total. They didn't have the number one seed. They were never fighting for that. But they are better than what they were last
and
season.
And post-All-Star break, they're the best team in the NBA.
All right, finally this morning, Anthony Davis has made it clear he wants out of New Orleans, but David Griffin, the new executive VP of basketball operations for the Pelicans, hasn't let go of AD just yet. So you're telling me there's a chance? He said yesterday he hopes the Brow has a change of heart, and if he does, the Pelicans will welcome him back with open arms. Nick, realistically, any chance AD stays in New Orleans?
I don't think there is any realistic chance he stays there, but David Griffin's doing the right thing. He gets the job, and his number one goal should be to get Anthony Davis to sign that supermax they can put in front of him. And so, of course, that's the mindset that David Griffin should have. But I also think he will quickly learn that Anthony Davis is not going to be moved off his desire to be traded. And so then we can just use what we know about David Griffin and what he has said in the last year in the media. Mm-hmm. He was asked directly a couple months ago, if you were running the Pelicans, what would you want back for Anthony Davis? And now he is running the Pelicans, mm-hmm. and he's going to be in a position to get something back for Anthony Davis. So what did he say? He said a young player that has the potential to be an all-star, at least one quality veteran that I can add to my team immediately, cap relief, and a lottery pick or two. That's the template that he laid out. Mm-hmm. So it was very specific. It wasn't I'd try to win right now. It wasn't I would just want a bunch of draft picks. It wasn't I would. So you then look across the league and you say, what teams could fit that bill? What teams could put together a package that fits exactly what David Griffin, the television analyst, said he would want if he were David Griffin, the team president? The other angle of this, C, and we talked about this before the show, is whether or not this opens the door back up for the Los Angeles Lakers, because David Griffin obviously was the GM of the Cleveland Cavaliers. I think that there are people that believe that, oh, well, he has a good relationship with LeBron. He has a good relationship with Rich Paul. So, therefore, that will make this to where he will steer him towards the Lakers. I think you feel the exact opposite on that point.
I do. I think it makes it harder because what David Griffin, because he's picking up a negotiation that had already started. And from everything that I'm hearing, the people in New Orleans, the Pelicans, they were not happy with how the Lakers tried to expose them and put all this information out there. So David Griffin's the only new face really in the building to start. Do they change their philosophy towards the Lakers and or the Celtics, the Knicks? Do they have a better offer? So there's other things besides just that relationship. So I think that Griff's number one responsibility is to the owner, because Griff said, when I take a job, I'm married to that ownership. That's why I'm going there, because I believe the ownership is going to support me. And then his first deal, a deal that already got started. So I would be more apt to say he's going to send him somewhere else, not just because of what happened with Magic and everything else, but there's other teams got better assets than what the Lakers have. So I think that Ingram's injury, it hurts the situation. Already starting a negotiation hurt the situation. And I believe that the Celtics are going to be real players and the Knicks.
What about Magic leaving? Does that help or hurt the situation? Was there bad blood between the Pelicans organization and Magic, or was it the Lakers? Question.
So here's what I think. I think that David Griffin is not going to do anyone favors. The idea that David Griffin's going to say, as my first order of business as the New Orleans Pelicans team president, I'm going to help out LeBron James.
Right.
That is not going to happen. But the reason I think in Los Angeles David Griffin's hiring was a relief for them, I think it's a hard reset. I think with Magic gone, with a new team president,
you think it's going to be fair?
Exactly.
Because he's very professional.
I think that David Griffin knows I signed a long-term contract with this team that, fair or not, is going to be defined in large part by what I get back for Anthony Davis. So I think David Griffin is going to play no favorites, but he's also going to have no crossouts. If it had been status quo in New Orleans, I think the Lakers might have been a crossout. I think they might have said, even if they present the best offer.
Or even if they said the right things publicly, behind the scenes,
forget those guys. We're not trading him to the Lakers. We're not giving him what he wants. David Griffin, we know, had very serious demands to take this job. He had a lot of jobs he could have potentially taken. He sat out of basketball a year when he didn't have to, waiting for the right job. He didn't take this job to not be able to take the deal that he thinks is the best deal. Now, that doesn't mean the Lakers can create the best deal. Ingram's blood clots are a huge thing. How these ping pong balls fall are a huge part of it.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that if it had just been, you know what, we're going to have an interim, we're going to have Mickey Loomis running things, the people that were in the building, they might not have fielded the Lakers' calls. Now, if the Lakers can present the best offer, I think Griffin would make that deal, but ties aren't going to go to the Lakers, and he's not going to do them any favors.
All right, let's move on to the Warriors now. They dropped Game 2 to the Clippers Tuesday night, in part because Kevin Durant was limited to just 8 field goal attempts. The reason why? Patrick Beverley. Despite being 8 inches shorter and nearly 60 pounds lighter than KD, Beverley has seemingly gotten under Durant's skin. Steve Kerr said he wants Durant to work around it, be more aggressive, shoot 20 to 30 shots in game three. Well, here's what KD had to say about that.
I'm not going to go out there and just go shoot 20 or 30 shots. You know, I don't play like that. So, I mean, we were up 30 points, so I had 5 shots. Everybody's shots were kind of evenly distributed around that time. We were up 30. So me taking 2 more shots after that wasn't the reason why we lost. They're playing a gimmick defense, which has been working, top blocking everything on the perimeter. So guys not even looking at the three-point line. They're just forcing guys inside the three-point line. So for us, when I get the ball in my spots, you know, I got a pest, Patrick Beverley, who was up underneath me. Well, I could definitely shoot over top and score every time if it's a one-on-one situation. But we got a guy that's dropping and helping, and then we got another guy that's just sitting on me waiting for me to dribble the basketball. If I put the basketball on the floor, I can, you know, I could probably make 43% of my shots if I shoot them like that. But that's not really going to do nothing for us at with the outcome of the game, you know, because we got a nice flow, everybody touching the rock, everybody shooting and scoring. So I'm not going to get in the way of the game because, you know, I want to have a little back and forth with Patrick Beverley. I'm Kevin Durant. You know who I am. Yeah. And this series is kind of weird because, you know, when the guy is that small, you know, you got the advantage. But, you know, the refs see, you know, we hear David and Goliath a lot growing up, you know, so that story is pretty much prominent in people's minds. So when you put that out there on the court against me, then the ref's going to give him a little bit more. So when he run up on me like a pit bull, grab me, hold me, I don't mind it. That's how he make his money. That's how he feed his family. But if I throw something back, then let us play. You get what I'm saying?
A lot of insight there. I know both of you differ a little bit on where you fall on this. But, Nick, what did you make of what KD had to say?
Listen, I think there's two people in the world that didn't just love what Kevin Durant said, me and Steve Kerr. I saw the entirety of my timeline just lauding Kevin Durant for what he said yesterday. And what KD said yesterday would have made perfect sense if this were the context. Warriors are up 2-0. They've won 2 games comfortably, but KD's averaging 13 points per game. It's like, hey, Kevin, what's going on with you? What's going on with your offense? He says, hey, I'm not going to let a one-on-one battle, my ego, get in the way of us winning. It, to me, makes no sense coming off the biggest blown lead in NBA playoff history. He is Kevin Durant. He can rise up and shoot over him every time. So while your team is falling apart, while Steph is on the bench and then ice cold in the fourth quarter, rising up and shooting over him is exactly what you needed to do. It's what I would expect Kevin Durant's going to have partially as a game plan this evening when they play. I appreciate him saying also, I'm Kevin Durant. I'm not going to get into a one-on-one battle with Patrick Beverley, except in game one with Patrick Beverley, you got in a one-on-one battle and got ejected. And in game two with Patrick Beverley, you got in a one-on-one battle and you had 4 offensive fouls en route to fouling out. So I appreciate the commentary, but I don't think it lines up with what we've seen in the first 2 games.
Well, it does line up because in those 2 games, he wasn't successful and he tried to go one-on-one. And what he was saying was, I'm not going to keep doing that because it's not the best style of basketball for me. I enjoyed the insight because when he talked about Patrick Beverley being underneath him, when he talked about the referees, like they're allowing Beverley to play his style. Now, I try to give Beverley a little something back, and they don't let us play. Kevin Durant got 5 offensive fouls called on him in 2 games. So for me, he gave us great insight. Also into, he talked about them being the gimmick defense. I haven't heard too many people say that besides having Patrick Beverley on him. He talked about the help side defender being in the lane, ready for him, because once he gets the ball, if he puts it on the deck, that guy is coming. He taught me so many things. Also, Steve Kerr's wrong as far as Kevin Durant should get 20, 30 shots. Well, Kevin Durant very seldom ever shoots 30 times, and he's one of the most selective, I would say the most efficient scorer that I've seen in the NBA the last 15 years. So he has a game plan. He talked about how he thinks about the game, when he gets the ball, what he's going to do. So for me, we have so many guys that are so talented. But when the mic's in their face, they don't say anything. They don't teach us anything. They don't help me out anything. So for me, when I heard that, because I've had a lot of times where the coach said certain things, and then when they gave me the mic, I knew that wasn't true. So I still kept my talking points because Kevin Durant talked about We were up by 31. How many shots did he had taken at that point?
Five.
Right. So his argument was right. Now, could he have been a little more aggressive? But when they were trying that gimmick defense, he was giving up the ball. They were being successful. He talked about the last month. That's how we've been doing it. That's how we've been winning. So for me, I thought it was very refreshing because most of these basketball players that play at that level, they're basketball geniuses. And every once in a while, I just want a little insight because I want to learn something new. And that was something that I hadn't heard from NBA players. And I've been following this game for a long, long time.
Well, the insight, though, that I did find most interesting was when he talked about how they're guarding him, not just with Beverly on him, because Landry Shamet's guarding him some as well, but the help side defense on him. And this is something that I found insightful and interesting, but maybe for a different reason most people did. Do you know what he described there? How almost every superstar in this league is guarded except for the ones on the Warriors, where an entire defense is built around stopping you. The Clippers have done something very few teams do. They have put the focus on KD instead of the focus on Steph. And KD thrived when he was with the Thunder, and defenses were built around stopping him. Maybe the last 3 years have made him forget to a degree what Harden goes through every night, Giannis, Kawhi, LeBron. When you are the MVP who's the best player on a team, which is the case for everyone except for Steph and KD who have each other, this is what these guys always go through.
Yeah, but I'm not going to judge KD when he's full of he's on a team full of superstars. What he does next year, we'll have commentary for that. Now, if he was to play like this next year on a regular team, then we got reason to criticize him. But when you're on Golden State, when you have more talent around you, you have to do less. The most talented teams I ever been on, the number one thing I had to do was swallow my pride and realize the ball is not coming my way as many times. So Kevin Durant, him sacrificing offensively, has made them a special team, and that's why they're trying to three-peat.
Since we started talking basketball on this show, this has been one of the most obvious mismatches that we've seen, especially in the playoffs. And I'm not a basketball genius. It seems obvious to me that Kevin Durant should win this mismatch, this battle, every single night. How much of this is mental, though? How much of this, what we heard in that soundbite, was mental?
Beverly's clearly in his head to a degree, and I respect and I always advocate for making the right play. And so with the point of we built the 31-point lead taking five shots is totally legitimate. But the 31-point lead was then blown. And in the course of that being blown, your best player simply saying, okay, maybe this isn't what we typically do, but we're in a crisis moment, so I am going to rise up and shoot. That, to me, is what we expect Kevin Durant to do when the guy guarding him is a foot shorter than
him. Kevin Durant could have been more aggressive in that time they made the comeback. But when you're in the comeback, no one knows they're going to come all the way back.
So you want to stick
with that. So Kevin Durant, 20 times in his career, he's taken 30 shots. All right, three times with Golden State. So forget what Steve Kerr is talking about.
Right.
Steve Kerr just talking to the media. Kevin Durant gave us some insight, and just like we have done since he made that decision, it's very seldom do we ever see any good in Kevin Durant and what he's doing. I'm so glad a guy plays the right way. LeBron James plays the right way. People criticize him. So let's try to keep that going with Kevin Durant. Kevin, you're doing right. Watch Kevin go off tonight.
Got a break there. Coming up, hey, what's the ceiling for Kyrie and the Celtics in the playoffs? That's still ahead on First Things First. Favorite time of the morning, NBA champ Steven Jackson is here.
What's up, man? Glad to be back. What's going on?
Thank you. I was hoping
I got
a little love
for that.
Versace,
Versace.
Versace, Versace.
Shout out, amigos.
That's obvious, Versace. I can tell you that. Nets and Sixers, Steven Jackson. Ah! Gearing up for game three tonight in Brooklyn after scoring just 9 points in the game one loss to the Nets. Ben Simmons bounced back with a triple-double in a game two win. Despite the strong performance, Brooklyn and CC just not that impressed. Jared Dudley said of Simmons, he's a great player in transition, but once you get him into half court, he's average. Fighting words. Steven, is Dudley right about Ben Simmons?
Truth sound like hate to people who hate the truth.
Oh, truth. Ooh.
Man, say that again.
Yes.
Say that again.
Truth sounds like hate to people who hate the truth. Wow. I mean, it's just the truth. He's not a good half-court player. As you see last game, he had success by getting the ball up the hoop, pushing it, and getting quick baskets. Mm-hmm. Half-court game is not his game. He can't shoot. He won't even shoot it. Jared Dudley, he's dead on, and I think that's the way they're going to approach guarding him. The same way, we know he's not going to shoot. Mm-hmm. We're going to slow him down when he gets the rebound and make him play him half-court because that's the reason they won last game.
Right. Every player has weaknesses in this game, and it's been just – talked about as far as Ben Simmons and his inability to shoot. Mm-hmm. My biggest problem with Ben Simmons is not his inability to shoot. Because even if you can't shoot, you shouldn't put yourself in a position where they can exploit your weaknesses. So if you're going to be one-dimensional, be the best one-dimensional player. So every time the ball went off the bucket, I would be trying to get in transition. Every time I tried to set up the offense the way they did, I would try to get a running start compared to a conventional guard setting up, calling the play, allowing everyone. I would move back a little bit so I can use my size and speed and try to get in the air over people. So my biggest thing with Ben Simmons is he doesn't know his game well enough that he plays it all the time. Mm-hmm. People force him to play their way. They force him. Jared Dudley is right. They force him to play in a half-court game. Now, in an up and down, if he was on the Showtime Lakers, he would be sensational mm-hmm. because they were up and down the court, pace, 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 pace. That's what Magic Johnson was best until he developed that shot. Now, Magic Johnson was a better player at a younger age, but that pace helped him out. My biggest problem with Ben Simmons is not that he can't shoot. Master what you can do. Yes, Dudley is right. He needs to get up and down more because he's almost unstoppable in the break, just like Giannis. You see the way Giannis is doing? Ben Simmons needs to be able to match a lot of what Giannis is doing until he develops that 15-foot jump shot.
And I would argue that is when he's on the court, that's the way they play. They are overall this year eighth in the league in pace. They're even faster when he's on the court as opposed to on the bench. And Jared Dudley's half right here because we're only talking about the offensive end now. Mm-hmm. Because nobody says Ben Simmons in half-court defense is not an elite player. Like, we know he is an elite defensive player for his position. We know he's an A-plus player in transition. And this actually, to me, is the perfect microcosm for why I get so frustrated with the Ben Simmons hyper-critiques. So he's a very good defensive player. He's an A-plus player in transition. Let's call him a C-minus player in half-court offense, right? Dudley called him average. So that would be a C. You want to call him a D player. Whatever you want to call him, fine. That averages out to a B-plus basketball player. That averages out to an all-star. Averages out to a guy that gave you 18, 9, and 8
for this season. You can still be an all-star and people be disappointed. When you are the first pick in the draft, life is about expectations.
Is that
right or not?
Of course, but do we expect guys to be their fully developed player in their second year in the league, third year in the league?
No, do we expect to see an arc? We expect to see someone go
exactly,
up. We talked
Jenna.
About how all offseason, at least he'd get better. The shooting didn't get any better.
Okay,
let's
be honest. Were you happy with Ben Simmons, what he did in his shooting department?
No.
Last year,
No, but that's
all we're talking about now.
But you're in the NBA. You should be able to even have a confidence to take a shot.
Take a shot.
Like, your man is sitting way in the paint. You're making
Jack, how many years you been retired?
5.
Okay. In the offseason, Jack, you work out hard. How many shots are you getting up a day right now?
A day, probably close to 100.
Agreed, but when
close
you say
at 41,
understood, and this is why you're the big three leading scorer 2 years.
But the point is though, you're in the NBA, you're an all star. How can you not shoot a jump shot? That's my thing.
So here's the thing, because see, you just said it, but that's what we're talking about. We're only talking about it because we're talking about it. This is the one player in the league, he and Russ, in my mind, that we spend such a disproportionate amount of time talking about what they can't do. Nobody denies what he's great at. So we just say, okay, he's great at it, forget it, it's not interesting. Let's talk about, yes, should he have gotten better at shooting?
We're talking about getting ready for game number 3. What do you want to talk about with him?
We could phrase the exact same conversation of, can the Nets prevent Ben Simmons from dominating the game
but they did it in game one. But it would still be based off Dudley's comments. He'd been like, hey, we got to slow him down. We got to put him in a half court. Then our comments would be, can they do that?
And if teams can't.
And it would go back to exactly what we're talking about. Is he going to ever be able to shoot?
If he's never able to shoot, then he will never reach his full potential.
I don't know. I know I'm on TV now,
mm-hmm.
and I know he can't shoot now.
Right, but
because he might be able to shoot one time, but I might not be on TV.
That's fine, but being on TV now, the last game he played in was maybe
sensational.
Absolutely.
Right.
And
was,
Go ahead.
Was it because of him, or was it because the other guys around him finally started to shoot?
No, it was because of him. No. He was the best player on the court. He was the guy that initiated everything. He was the difference maker. He was the one who adjusted his awful approach in game one to a great approach in game two.
Nick, it's I think there's tremendous irony to the two people that you mentioned. Both of them you like. Mm-hmm. Russ, you think he gets criticized too much. He ain't had no playoff success after averaging a triple-double, triple-double. Mm-hmm. Because in professional sports, you know what they pick out? He's not in college no more. They pick out the things that you can't do. If you're a good player, they pick out the things that you can't do. If you're a great player, they pick out the things that you haven't done or you can't do. That's what professional sports is about. It's not always about potential. It's about what do you do on a daily basis.
And I know a lot of great regular season players. What separates them is when they do it in the playoffs. At the same time, I got to reiterate this. How can you be in the NBA? How can you be an all-star and cannot shoot? That's the biggest problem.
Because you must be amazing at everything else.
No, it's not. It's not about being amazing. It's about having enough confidence to attempt a shot. You're not even trying. Like, you can at least try. That's my whole problem. Like, you're not even trying. At least give yourself a chance.
All right, we got a break there. I can assure you we'll have this conversation again. Stephen, we'll see you a little bit later in the show. Coming up, do the Seahawks have enough talent to live up to Russell Wilson's comments?
That's trash can, 21 feet.
Let's see.
Ben Simmons got to move 18
feet. We'll have the conversation again.
FS1 is your destination for the day's best sports shows. Tune in for the biggest personalities on the big stories. We get you started right here on First Things First. Catch it on Monday through Friday, only on FS1. Back here,
Bart,
we are
Scott.
Now joined.
Oh, what's going on? Shot in his shoes.
Linebacker Bart Scott. What's
that? That's my guy.
That'd be 350.
Can't wait for Bart Scott to come.
Hey, what's that suit? Blue steel, man?
There you go. Oh.
No, y'all get an invoice. Man, may cost you a lot.
Good things are happening. Thank you very much.
I feel a lot less comfortable about
that
one. Taking
the show to a new low.
Don't be getting that toe jam off in your nose.
That's weird. Time for your gamey. Subway choice moment. Russell Wilson is now the highest paid player in football history. Bart, after signing a 4-year, $140 million extension with a $65 million signing bonus, Wilson has already brought one Super Bowl to Seattle and came within a yard of bringing them another one. Yesterday, the quarterback said he has even more Super Bowls to win. So, Bart Scott, do the Seahawks have enough talent around him to contend for a Super Bowl this year?
I don't believe they do. I think they were ahead of schedule, with the rebuild, the reload, whatever they were going through. That's 10 cents.
Just admit it. These guys both looked at me immediately. Thank you.
I think they're ahead of schedule, but what the position that Russell Wilson has put his team in is that they have to be high percentage decision makers, meaning that they're going to have to be like the Saints, because he's taking so much of the pie that now he's going to have to be a hole filler and he's going to have to do more with less. He's never had a premier receiver. Just ask CeCe. He'll tell you about Baldwin and all those guys.
I love those guys. Those guys came after me.
They're scrappy.
They're meaner on Twitter than they are on the field.
They're scrappy, but what happens is now he's going to have to make up for the lack of depth on the offensive line, the lack of all-star premium players. When you go down the list of their roster, it's nobody that pops out on you. I mean,
nobody on the offensive side of the ball scares you.
I mean, and on the defensive side, they're hiring, felons. They got Michael Kendricks out there. He's still, we don't know when he's going to get locked up, when he has a court date. Mm-hmm. That's what you have to do. You have to get supplemental players. You got to get players that's going to come in and that wants to play, that's looking for jobs. And, what I can say about Pete Carroll and his staff is they always have been great in evaluating talent, finding talent, and also developing talent. We never had heard of Cam Chancellor. You think about Richard Sherman. He was a fifth-round draft pick. They're going to have to do one of those runs, because they used to be the model, CC.
Yes.
They used to be the model. Get a young quarterback, go through your run before you have to pay him, go get hired guns, go get a Michael Bennett, go out and get, but now they can't do that. Now they're going to have to hit on the draft. They're going to have to be high percentage decision makers and hit on the draft over and over again. And they did a smart thing. They put $65 million in the signing bonus. That means that, it's going to have a cap hit, but they can get most of that money out now and try and get relief on the back end of it. And we'll see. We'll see. But he's going to have to play a punch above his weight. And I don't know if he can do that and sustain it for 5 years.
Well, that's the way he's been doing the last several years. There are very few franchises can do what Seattle is currently trying to do. And they're trying to rebuild at a high level.
While contending.
There's only a few franchises can do it, and they're going to have to do it by paying their quarterback. Russell has deserved this money. So we should move on from that conversation. Now there's just going to be a lot of conversation. NFL salary cap, $188 million, 0.2. Can you win giving a guy a large portion of it? So that will be the conversation. What they've done through the personnel department is they have spent well as far as draft picks and free agents being able to acquire some talent, and their coaching staff, even though they've lost a lot of coaches to other organizations, head coaches and defensive coordinators, offensive coordinators, they develop their talent well. Now, Russell is going to have to play with less, a lot like Tom Brady does without the salary cap restrictions. That's what Russell's going to have to get through. And you got to be able to get through your mind, he's earned the money, but regardless of what their playing style is, you can't back a quarterback up with that bad offensive line 45 times. So how am I going to win? A lot like New England won in the playoffs, they turned to a running team when other teams were trying to throw it. Seattle is trying to rebuild at a high level. They are successfully doing it, and it all starts with Russell Wilson, who I believe one of the best players that we have in the league.
I think the NFC is the deeper of the conferences. But this year, when I'm looking at the teams, when I saw this question, can they contend? I was going team by team of the teams we think should be good to very good. And all of them that I could come up with, except for maybe New Orleans, has a glaring question mark. With Philadelphia, is can Wentz play a full season? With Chicago, it's how good is Trubisky? With the Rams, is Todd Gurley's knee going to allow him to be anything like Todd Gurley? You go every team in the NFC North. Like, there's, you can go down the list and say, wait, what is this team, do we know they're great at, and what's their biggest weakness? And because I can't find a team, aside from maybe New Orleans, that seems to check every box, do I think a team that won 10 games last year should be better this year, has Pete Carroll as the head coach, and has Russell Wilson in the heart of his prime, do I think they can compete for a championship? Yeah, I do. Do I think they can do what they've done his entire career there, which is average 11-plus wins? Sure. And so they are one of, to me, a half dozen teams at the top of the NFC that you can pick apart what their weaknesses are. I would say their weakness is lack of elite talent on offense, or we could focus on what they are great at, which is a great home field advantage, a great quarterback that is as good as anyone in the league in the fourth quarter.
And you mentioned that home field. The reason why I don't think they can compete for a Super Bowl, because I don't think they can get enough games at home. I don't think they can win 12 games in the regular season to get the number one or two seed. Do I think they can go to New Orleans and be able to beat them? Nope. Can they go to Minnesota and be able to beat them? Nope. Go to Green Bay and be able to beat them in the playoff? Nope. So, yes, I got the home field advantage part, but if you can't get to 12 wins to utilize that to get the number one seed, you are a team, and in Pete Carroll's era, they are two different teams, one at home and one on the road. And they are not a top five defense. The style for which they run, they have to be a top five defense. They got to get home field advantage. So, yes, they'll compete, but it won't be for Super Bowls because I believe that they're still rebuilding.
Well, they remind me much of the teams that I was a part of, right? They're going to ground and pound, and they're going to limit the possessions of the game, hoping that Russell Wilson can be special in the fourth quarter. He's become smarter, you know, now that he knows he doesn't have the support for defense to pitch shutouts, and he chooses to select to run late in games and pivotal situations. But with that being said, he's going to be in a lot of tight ball games because they're not going to be putting up a lot of points. So yes, then you expect him to be special, and then when he tries to become special, if he gets hurt or dinged up like he was a couple seasons ago with the knee, then that's going to limit their offense and limit the ability for him to be special. They're going to have to try and hit on a draft and get him some explosive players down the field that can get some easy scores. It's going to have to be play action, play action, play action. You know what I mean? Run, take shots. Nothing in between, because they won't be able to go methodically down the field on a consistent basis. Too many things can happen, especially when you have a porous offensive line that's going to get a penalty and get behind the sticks because they can't continue to hold up because they have a lack of talent.
And on the draft, they have fewer draft picks than any team in the league right now with just four.
Thank you for listening to the First Things First podcast. Remember, leave us a review and tell us what you think. Subscribe to the podcast on Apple Podcasts and catch us on FS1 Monday through Friday, 6:30 a.m. Eastern. For Chris Carter and Nick Wright, I'm Jenna Wolf. So long, everybody.